Hi, my name is Dan Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I also blog at foreignpolicy.com. And with me today is Rob Farley from the Patterson School at the University of Kentucky, and he blogs at lawyersgunsandmoney.com, although that's not exactly true right now, is it?
It's www.lawyersgunsmoneyblog.com, but there are some technical issues. Yeah, there are some technical issues that resulted in... It's a long story that nobody here wants to hear. Bitterness, anger, technicians telling me that I should stop yelling at them and so forth. So,
speaking of bitterness and anger, we might as well segue to the topic that we're supposed to be talking about, which is probably one that's going to put all of our Blogging Heads listeners to sleep, which is Israel.
Right.
So we're blogging, I think, 48 hours after the IDF had a spot of trouble trying to prevent a flotilla of ships armed with supplies for Gaza to try to break the blockade. There's lots of videos out there. Suffice to say, I think 10 people on those ships are dead. There's videos showing that... Are they dead? I can't remember.
10 people are dead, I think. Yeah. 3 Israelis are injured, and I think more of the members of the flotilla are injured.
Right. The members of the flotilla are slowly, I think, being released now by Israel. They've been incarcerated by Israel, but they're going to be released. And let's just say this has caused a massive global firestorm of controversy.
Bit of a fracas.
What?
Bit of a fracas.
It's a fracas. It's a to-do. It's an imbroglio. Mm-hmm. You know what? This is above kerfuffle.
I think that it's fair to say that at this point.
Yeah. There's a bunch of questions we want to ask on this. I think the first small one that I'm kind of curious about is the Israelis knew this flotilla was coming. I mean, I don't know if you got these emails. I kept getting these blast emails from the IHH, the group that was organizing this, saying, "We're coming, we're coming," and these are the things I normally immediately send in my spam folder. So it was obvious that people knew this flotilla was coming. Is there any way tactically you think they could have handled this better?
I mean, it's an interesting question. As I understand it, and I should say that on questions like these, non-specialists on the Israel-Palestine dispute are always going to fall behind in terms of, you know, access to the raw data behind the dire fanatics on either side. So you dire fanatics out there, please excuse me for what I get wrong.
So I raised my hand when you said non-specialist, so yes.
Right. Yeah. So my understanding is that 5 of the 6 ships had been peacefully boarded by the IDF. In the 6th ship, they attempted the passengers on the ship were aware of the boarding attempt, and the IDF attempted called a fast rope dismount from helicopters, and they essentially dismounted right into a crowd of angry club-wielding protesters.
Yeah.
Which, as I understand it, is not the state of the art in fast rope dismounting from helicopters. and that then resulted in they were carrying non-lethal weapons, but they were also carrying lethal weapons, and they then resorted to the lethal weapons. Could they have done this better? Yeah. I mean, really. I mean, anything would have been better, I think, than what they did on this 6th ship. And I think... It's been very rare for me to read even any pro-Israel commenters commenting positively on the execution of this particular operation.
No, I mean, most of those blogs I've read have suggested that the mistake they made was actually trying to use the non-lethal force in the first place. They should have been coming in better armed, expecting something like this when they boarded the ship. And, you know, it's a fair statement. That's a fair point, I think.
Right, right, and there are alternative things that potentially could have been done that would have put the onus on the protesters to proceed, certain types of ways that the IDF Navy could have used its ships and blockaded, and so forth. So, but I mean, really, this was badly done. And whether they had gone in with more lethal force, which going in with more lethal force doesn't necessarily mean they would have gone in shooting.
Right, that's my point. Yeah, I'm not saying they go in with lethal force and kill everyone. I'm saying the lethal force might have actually prevented, subdued the people on the ship without the loss of life.
It would have had suppressive effect.
The potential
for lethal force would have had suppressive effect.
Yeah.
And so the outcome of all this, of what I think is almost universally agreed to be a botched seizure of this ship and the killing of the 10, is that Israel is enduring even more international condemnation than Israel normally receives. And it's enduring such condemnation from some countries, like Turkey, which it hasn't traditionally in the past endured such attacks from. And so this is, I mean, I think everybody is agreeing, and Netanyahu cancels his trip to the United States and to meet with President Obama and so forth. And so, yeah, it's a problem. It's a significant public relations issue right now for Israel. Not to mention the 10 people who got killed.
Yeah, which is
a larger issue.
I guess one question we should first ask is this anything more than a public relations problem? I mean, I think there is probably universal consensus that this is an unmitigated PR disaster for the Israelis,
right,
and particularly for the IDF. Which, you know, in some ways, one of the sources of power, I think you can argue, that Israel has had for decades was this either myth or perception of IDF, utter IDF supremacy when it came to things like combat tactics.
Right.
And, you know, this is not the first time in the last couple of years they've made this kind of mistake. And you know, that reputation is being tarnished very quickly.
Right. And this was sort of, I mean, I think a lot of people are drawing connections between this event, sort of a direct line between this event and the 2006 Hezbollah war.
Right.
And in the 2006 war, the IDF did not perform as well as some people in Israel and some people around the world expected. And there's a legitimate debate whether Hezbollah simply outperformed expectations or whether the IDF underperformed.
Yeah.
You know, just like a baseball game, it sort of depends on the quality of the opposition. And there's a good reason to believe that Hezbollah was very good opposition in that war. But people have argued that the entire Gaza incursion, Operation Cast Lead, or Cast Lead, I'm not sure how they're pronouncing it, was designed to reinvigorate the IDF, to recreate deterrence such that people feared the IDF again. And in this particular situation, I think what you have is almost a recreation of certain things like the raid on Entebbe, where the
certain
IDF...
Certain things like the what? I'm sorry. Oh, the raid on Entebbe, yeah.
The raid on Entebbe, where the IDF carried out, or not even the IDF, but, well, this was an IDF unit, but
the
IDF or other special military or paramilitary units in Israel carried out just extremely well-coordinated, well-executed small operations. And I think this was supposed to be something like that, and it didn't work out.
No, if anything, the reverse has occurred. I mean, my understanding is IHH has announced they're planning on sending more ships as soon as possible to Gaza.
Right, right. And these ships are proceeding with the blessing of Turkey. And that...
Which is another question,
Right. That, in terms of the public relation, may be the single largest issue. Because relations between Israel and Turkey have been tense ever since the Gaza war. And some people would argue they've been tense since the election of a quasi-Islamic government in Turkey. But they've certainly been tense since the Gaza war, and they're even much, much more tense right now.
Right. I mean, there was the Gaza war, there was the reaction by the Erdogan government, particularly Erdogan at Davos, I think in early 2009, where he blasts Shimon Peres. There was the Israeli, Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign ministry, brought in the Turkish, I love this, they brought in the Turkish ambassador to protest a 24-style television show being aired in Turkey, and then made him sit at what was essentially like a kiddie table, and then brought in the press to show the photos.
Right, and then Danny Ayalon went out there and berated him in Hebrew in front of the press, and so,
was... And that always, you know, wins you lots of friends and supporters.
Right.
And now we have this. Erdogan is, I mean, saying... I mean, you know, as much as Israel might have screwed the pooch, Erdogan is, I mean, he's compared this to 9/11, which strikes me as a small amount of hyperbole.
It's a touch of hyperbole. And what I've seen some arguments make is that Erdogan has been looking for a way to end the positive Turkish relationship with Israel, which had been supported by secular elements within the Turkish government
and the Turkish military in particular,
right, and that by sort of extra hyping this event, what he does is essentially batters down domestic critics on the Israel relationship, which seems it's a plausible explanation to me. It explains his behavior in this particular case. So that seems almost quasi-reasonable.
And it also seems to be working, because my understanding is the secular opposition in Turkey has voiced there hasn't been a lot much daylight between Erdogan and them after the flotilla was attacked.
Right, right. Well, and I'm not sure how much public daylight you would see. I mean, yeah. You would probably see some discussion through proxies and so forth. But yeah, right now there's little indication that that anybody in Turkey has very warm feelings about the Israel relationship. And what's interesting to me is that there appear to be people in Israel, and including people in the foreign ministry, who don't seem to think that that's a problem.
I don't get.
Yeah, it worries me about Israel's strategic sense that they don't think that this is a problem. Because it seems like a big problem to me.
To be fair to Israel, there is one calculation you can make where I would understand this, where they would say, they look at Erdogan and what he's doing, and I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but they look at Erdogan, they look at his domestic situation, and they think it doesn't matter what they do. Mm-hmm. Erdogan's going to continue to act in his bellicose manner, trying to trigger provocations, because this is the way in which he's expanding his domestic base. Mm-hmm. That I would sort of almost understand, but you're right, it doesn't seem like that's the calculation they're making. The calculation they're making seems to be, we don't need Turkey anyway.
Right, and even if that were the case, I mean, there would be ways to combat what Erdogan, and I assume you're pronouncing it right. I have no idea. There are ways. We're just IR scholars. We don't know anything.
Blogging has our headline. Okay, yeah.
Right, exactly. There are ways of going about responding to this kind of domestic base building that Erdogan may be engaging in that would maintain the relationship with the parts of the Turkish elite that you want to maintain the relationship with. But dressing down the Turkish ambassador is not one of those ways, right? I mean, it only makes it worse. It makes Erdogan's job easier if that, in fact, is what he's doing. And what really sort of surprised me and really sort of I thought was almost insane was the idea that Israel seems to have that cozying up to Greece right now, cozying up to the Greek military, is somehow a way to push Turkey into line. So playing classic balance of power politics, only with the bankrupt weaker partner in the balance of power relationship is supposed to somehow frighten Turkey. And that frightening Turkey is somehow something that they want to do. It's crazy.
I'm sure they're thinking the Rumsfeldian line, you engage in realpolitik with the allies you get. Right. But you're right. I mean, there's obviously no way that Greece is prepared in any way whatsoever to make life difficult for Turkey. They lack the capacity. There's also the small matter that they're both members of NATO.
Right.
And
the Greeks themselves canceled the military maneuvers they had with the Israelis because of this incident.
Yeah.
Shockingly enough.
So, part of this, I assume, is that the foreign ministry is being run by Lieberman, who is, I don't know how to put this. He's a very canny politician domestically. I mean, he's clearly got some domestic support, otherwise he wouldn't be in the coalition, but is just all thumbs on the global stage.
Right. Well, there seems to be an attitude. I think it's most clear from Lieberman, but it is also evident in other parts of the Israeli government and the Israeli strategic elite that it's just no longer worth it to try to make any concessions to global public opinion. That this is essentially a lost cause, that we might as well give up and say done with it. And again, you asked earlier, does this public relations stuff ever matter?
Yeah.
And frankly, I think it does. It's the difference between people sort of mildly disliking Israel but not really caring about it, and between people, sort of being more tolerant of active efforts to harm Israel. And I think it matters in Israel's friends, the United States and parts of Europe and what used to be Turkey. I think it's a serious problem that the Israeli strategic elite has right now in conceptualizing their relationship with the world.
Well, not to mention the fact that, one of the things that the Israeli strategic elite presumably is obsessed about right now is Iran's nuclear program.
Right.
It's funny because the day after this flotilla attack, the IAEA issued a report blasting Iran pretty clearly for being non-compliant in terms of reporting and being unwilling to provide information about the nuclear program. This ordinarily would have been great momentum for the Security Council to go ahead in terms of sanctions and to present a united front against Iran. But, after the Israeli thing, that's going to be that much more difficult to do. It'll probably still happen. But, at a minimum, this raises the transaction costs for doing this kind of thing. And, in a bigger sense, there's going to be a lot of people that might ordinarily be at least somewhat sympathetic with the idea that Iran is acting like a transgressor state, now asking, why the hell is there so much, animus against Iran when Israel seems to be, acting in an equally bellicose manner?
Right, and I don't think the allegations that came out last week or the week before about Israel at least playing or at least mooting the possibility of selling nuclear weapons to South Africa in the 1970s, those aren't helpful in this context either, especially in the Iran context, especially in terms of fears of Iranian proliferation and so forth.
I mean,
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, in some ways, the global public opinion question, I think, it boils down to two questions. The first is, does this matter? Does this genuinely affect Israeli security? Because you can argue, as much as global public opinion has, will turn against Israel, does that actually lead to genuine policy changes by the rest of the world? And then the second issue, of course, is how does it affect public opinion in the United States?
Right.
Which is, let's face it, Israel's chief great power benefactor, and will that cause eventually a shift in U.S. policy towards Israel?
Right. Well, what are your thoughts on those two questions?
I mean, globally, I assume that what it's going to do is just make life rhetorically that much more difficult for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting to see a situation where Israel is, this is a point I made in my blog, that Israel is increasingly being treated as a pariah actor in the same way that a country like, let's say, North Korea is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to equate the domestic situations in Israel and North Korea. That's obviously not the case. But both of them are seen as sort of transgressive actors at the global stage and remarkably unpopular except for their great power benefactor. Now, the question is whether any other state matters in terms of affecting Israeli security. And here I do think Turkey does matter. Because, Turkey is a NATO member. Turkey can make life, more miserable for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, in some ways, if Turkey acts in a more belligerent fashion towards Israel, I do wonder if you're going to start seeing some outbidding phenomenon among the rest of the Middle East countries that here to date, and particularly with the rise in the Iranian threat, have been willing to at least have some sort of sotto voce coordination with Israel. I mean, it's worth remembering that Egypt has cooperated with Israel on the blockade of Gaza, and I think after this latest to-do has now, they're going to allow land passage of humanitarian stuff into Gaza. Saudi Arabia is going to probably respond in the same way, and that's not good for Israel's strategic situation. So that's an issue. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think you're exactly right there to focus on the other Arab countries that have essentially, reached this modus vivendi with Israel,
mm-hmm.
where at least the elite is relatively comfortable with the existence of Israel, is relatively comfortable even with the military role that Israel plays in potentially deterring Iran and so forth.
Yep.
But that's really hard now for, especially in Egypt, right? Even to the extent that elite actors in the Egyptian government want to help Israel out, which is, are they tolerating, do they want to help out, and so forth, it becomes increasingly difficult to do that without really angering the population. And the same thing in Saudi Arabia, the same thing in Jordan. And in that sense, I think, as you suggest, the global public opinion really does matter. Another area in which it might matter is countries that just sort of genuinely don't care about these kinds of questions, like, South Korea, Japan, Brazil, and so forth, how they start thinking about the rogue status of Israel, or if they start thinking about the rogue status of Israel. Just because it's difficult to engage in diplomatic relations with a bunch of countries because you're friends with Israel. And that will be interesting, too, to see how that plays out, to see how politics in these countries that are largely indifferent to the basic matter of this dispute continue to regard Israel in the future.
I'm actually particularly intrigued to see how China responds to this.
Right.
Because there are ways in which China has strategic interests, obviously, with the Iran and Saudi Arabia in terms of where it gets its energy from.
Mm-hmm.
But there are ways in which China and Israel have actually had a tighter relationship than one would necessarily expect, in large part through things like defense contractors.
Right.
And also, if any country is going to be sympathetic to the notion of a government, putting down rest of populations in its borders, it's probably going to be China.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting to see the way China plays this going forward. I agree with you on that. The larger issue, ironically, is that as much as, it's ostensibly official U.S. policy to democratize or to push for democratization in the Middle East, in the long term, these kinds of Israeli policies are going to make that a strategic nightmare. Turkey is in some ways exhibit A about this. I mean, at the same time that you've had Erdogan, taking an increasing anti-Israeli bent, he's also taken steps to sort of put the military of Turkey in its place to sort of, to preserve the idea of civilian rule.
Right.
But you're, what you're now seeing is what happens when, in fact, a Muslim leader in the Middle East has to cater to his country's, or tries to build support within his population in order to boost his political standing. Right. So, you know, if you've got more democratization across the rest of the Middle East, that's what all these governments are eventually going to be doing.
Right, and I think that has to be a serious concern. And it's interesting that if you read the literature coming out of the Israeli right, you find two points that relate to what you just said. The first is a deep skepticism about Turkish democracy.
Right.
And not just a deep skepticism about Turkish democracy, but about deep skepticism about democracy in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, you have arguments that democratizing or making an effort to democratize Iraq in the wake of the 2003 war was a terrible idea because, you know, look what might happen. People might hate us if you democratize Iraq. But you've also, in a couple places, and this might lead to our next point, talking about the potential to seek out another great power patron or to seek out other strategic options for Israel. And I have seen a couple arguments, one by Carolyn Glick and, where else should I read it? But I guess so Carolyn Glick would be the first one to come to mind, to start thinking about China as a potential great power patron, option to the United States.
Oh, really? So the idea that Israel would engage in balancing behavior. Oh, that's interesting. Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
Which strikes me as blithely insane on the Israeli, from the Israeli point of view. The idea that you will ever have a patron that is willing to sacrifice as much for Israel as the United States is strikes me as just plain crazy. But there is at least, it looks to be some kind of thought about or along those lines in terms of seeking out another potential patron. Which, you know, we can either continue talking about Israel, Palestine, or we can sort of now move on to the larger question of patron client and the other country that suffers from an unruly client right now, if we wish to characterize the U.S.-Israeli relationship in such a fashion.
Well, I think we do, and I would further point out this once again shows that in some ways the deteriorating strategic situation for Israel, which is tactically on the ground, they're not in a bad situation. I mean, they're far and away the most powerful military in the region, and you know, you can say what you will about the policies they pursued in the last 5 years, but they have done a decent job of reducing the number of terrorist attacks within Israel proper. But that said, you know, it's worth remembering that you know, when Israel was created, you know, you had the great powers competing for attention for Israel. I mean, one of the reasons the U.S. recognizes Israel in 1948 is because the Soviet Union was going to recognize Israel.
Right.
France had a long-standing relationship with Israel up until, I think, the Six-Day War that was relatively tight. And now you've got, you know, a situation where Israel is looking for, you know, if it was not for the United States, Israel would be in much, much deeper trouble. And it's very clear that the United States went to the mat at the Security Council session that was held on Monday to basically water down the language. I mean, there was this great quote from Ben Smith of Politico where a U.S. official basically said something to the effect of, we're the only ones that, you know, even believe, you know, what the Israelis are saying at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, strikes me as a remarkable parallel to what's going on with regard to China and North Korea. You know, North Korea sank the Chonan and you've been all over this in terms of the blogging. In all likelihood, you know, I think the overwhelming evidence suggests that a North Korean torpedo sank the boat.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that South Korea did not ask for international help, but issued their own report, and that seems to be going down relatively well. I think the perception is that, you know, the report is fairly accurate, and has put China in a particularly sticky situation in terms of how it's going to respond. And in this sense, the parallels between what North Korea is doing and what Israel is doing seem pretty damn strong. I mean, am I wrong in this?
It's interesting, and first I should note that I have been following conspiracy theories about the sinking of the Chonan, and there is a substantial portion of the South Korean left that believes the government has just made up the whole thing. But also I have found arguments that in fact the Chonan was sunk by an Israeli submarine.
It all comes together.
Brings it together. It brings it all together, doesn't it?
I was joking about that because I made that joke in my first blog post on Israel where I said, you know, within a week they're going to be blamed for the sinking of the Chonan and the cancellation of Law and Order. But, you know, so this is great that it all comes together.
Yes. So that is a conspiracy theory out there. You can cite it as an actual conspiracy theory now that the Israelis sank the Chonan for some reason. Perhaps to distract the world from what they would be doing several months hence, when they might accidentally kill somebody. I have no idea. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I mean, China obviously has a North Korea problem, and I think it's right to characterize it as a North Korea problem. Some people are arguing that North Korea is all just part of China's grand strategic plan, and you know, they're actually really supportive of North Korea, and I don't think that that's true. I mean,
I think they barely tolerate North Korea. I mean, they don't want to see the country go away. I mean,
right.
The argument I've always made about North Korea is that the current setup, basically, every country in the region favors the status quo except North Korea, mm-hmm. Because the status quo basically allows for North Korea to exist as a buffer state, which makes China happy. It allows South Korea not to have to bankroll the reunification, which is going to be incredibly expensive.
Right.
North Korea doesn't win, however, because even though it has nuclear weapons, it's not getting anything for them. And
it makes Japan happy because Japan does not, and I think in the long run, want a unified Korea. Unified Korea is
right.
Huge.
Right, and China doesn't want a unified Korea, obviously, right. You know, either. And I think deep down, I'm not sure the U.S. necessarily wants a unified Korea, because if that happens, the first thing a unified Korea would do would be to kick the Americans out.
Right.
Yeah. So as a result, North Korea has been the only country that wants to change the situation, and they've made life very difficult for China. And, I mean, you're starting to see, the beginnings of an internal debate within China about what the hell do they do with a country like North Korea, because it really is embarrassing for them.
Right. It's a real problem, and it was, I think that the reason that the South Koreans did take so long, I mean, I've long been of the opinion that the South Koreans probably knew within 2 or 3 days had sunk the Chonan, because, you know, a rock or a mine, I mean, a studied naval architect, are the difference between these things are fairly obvious, mm-hmm. and so I think the South Koreans were just very cagey, very careful, because they wanted to present as compelling a case to the Chinese as they could, and the Russians
right.
too, and the Russians are sort of play the same role in this that they play in many things, which is you know, something between sort of a hostile court jester, I guess.
The passive aggressive court jester, yes, I like
passive aggressive court jester. So I think you're right that the Chinese have a significant problem here with North Korea. But it's interesting. I mean, I guess thinking about patron-client relations more generally, you know, way back in the Cold War, there's all this literature about how important patrons are and what the relationship between patrons and clients are, and people worried a lot. Are we going to lose Egypt? Is Egypt going to go over to the Russians, or is the Russians worried? Is Egypt going to go over to the Americans, and so forth? And a lot fewer countries switched than actually maybe should have switched. And, you know, the reasons for that, I think, or one of the most important reasons for that is that when you have a patron-client relationship, you actually build up domestic constituencies in both countries in favor
right.
of that relationship. So constituencies that work for the status quo. And, you know, on the Israel-U.S. relationship, people have written whole books about this question, and so we don't really, you know, need to delve into that. But, you know, it's there, right, the idea
yeah.
that in both countries you have a domestic constituency, both inside and outside of government, that supports maintenance of the status quo.
Right.
I wonder if the North Korea relationship has that kind of constituency within China, or whether China views this in sort of straightforward cold realpolitik terms. I mean, I wonder if there are people there saying, well, yeah, they're a little bit crazy, but, you know, they've been our friend forever, and so we can't really mess with them, and so forth. I wonder whether there are those voices within
yeah.
the Chinese government and the Chinese security establishment, or whether it's all just, well, you know, they're crazy, but they might collapse, and we don't want that. So
I suspect there is probably a bureaucratic interest. I mean, part of the mm-hmm. problem here is that, you know, this is where the analogy falls short. I mean, when you talk about the U.S.-Israel relationship, because both countries are democracies, mm-hmm. the interest groups that exist are not just in government, they're also out of government.
Right. Right.
And so as a result, they can, you know, they can make life politically difficult if the relationship is altered in some way. And I think you can argue that, you know, the past year of Obama and Netanyahu's, you know, relatively stormy relationship is mm-hmm. Exhibit A on this, which is, you know, in response to that, and in response to the pressure that Obama put on Netanyahu, you know, there was a lot of blowback within the United States, and as a result, right until this incident, I think Obama had spent the last 3 months basically engaging in an outreach effort to various members, to Jewish Democrats and so forth, saying, look, I get it now in Israel, and so this incident has threatened all that, to
right.
tear all that asunder. In the case of China and North Korea, you know, there's obviously no, from what you can tell, there's no broad-based societal interest to care about this necessarily. Right. I do agree. I think it's interesting whether, let's say, old guard, you know, communists, for example, that, you know, look back with nostalgia at the sort of lips and teeth strategy of China and North Korea might want that relationship. And or people, you know, based in Manchuria, that the last thing they want to see is either a collapsing North Korea or a reunified South Korea, which is what would happen if in the end they start, if the regime collapses. So I suspect there are those interests there. I think what's interesting, actually, is you're starting to see more and more public discontent among sort of China's foreign policy community, the think tank and university side, saying, what the hell are we doing defending this regime? Because it just, you know, all it does is give us agita. So, and that might all, again, just be for show. I think you're right that within Zhongmenghai, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but within the sort of the Chinese leadership inner sanctum, their realpolitik calculations probably look, we're going to tolerate what North Korea does, you know, right up until the moment they actually trigger a general war. And I think it's interesting that in the past week, it's been very clear that North Korea and South Korea have sort of stepped away from whatever abyss they were starting to look at, where North Korea indicated, I mean, I find this fascinating, that North Korea indicates it wants to keep that Kaesong industrial complex in operation, and South Korea's indicated, look, we don't want to disrupt that either. Maybe we'll rethink this psychological warfare thing, you know, which I guess does lead in the end to sort of the triumph of interests over rhetoric on this question.
Right, and as I understand it, some of President Lee's constituency has actually argued pretty hard for that. Some of his constituents in small business and so forth would suffer the most from a real long-term full economic blockade of the North. And so he has domestic reasons to have exactly the right kind of response to the North, rather. I mean, it has been very interesting following the performance of the South Korean government because there were really so many places where they could have gone wrong here, really badly wrong. And from my point of view, they seem to have done all right.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my assessment as well on this. I mean, I don't think they've ratcheted up the rhetoric too much. I agree with you. Their sort of go slow policy in terms of revealing what they thought happened to the Cho'onan seems relatively wise. And also, it's allowed them to get away with, well, not get away, but it's allowed them to agree on a few things with the United States that would normally get the North Koreans completely up in arms, such as engaging in regular military exercises.
Right, anti-submarine exercises off the the west coast of South Korea, which is exactly where the submarine or the North Korean submarine sank the South Korean ship, and so it's obviously some kind of it could potentially be viewed as a provocation. Here's a question: have you been following the situation in Japan, where I believe the Prime Minister just resigned today?
Hariyama just resigned. I know that the base question on Okinawa was probably the triggering issue on this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I followed it a little bit. I think Steve Clemens wrote a post over at the Washington Note that I pretty much completely disagreed with, where he argued, you know, why is Obama, you know, causing Hariyama to resign when in fact he should cause Netanyahu to resign, which I think massively overestimates Obama's ability to manipulate these things in both cases. Also, I think he's vastly overestimating Hariyama's competence.
As if Obama could just tip over the prime minister of a country with 140 million people in the world's second largest economy.
Yeah.
That would be impressive.
Well, I mean, I will say this. It does create some echoes of what happened in 1993-94 when Clinton came to power, again, as a new democratic reformer. And at the same time, you had Moriko Hosokawa, who was the first non-LDP premier of Japan since Japan had regained their independence in 1949. And again, it was the same sort of thing where there was a relatively frosty relationship between the Clinton administration and the Hosokawa administration. That time it was about trade ties. And it took a couple of years after the Hosokawa government fell, and if memory serves, I think Joe Nye did some signal work on this, to repair the military relationship. In this case, as I understand it, I mean, there are two things that were going on. The first is the Hariyama government did not execute things competently on most fronts. Once they took over, I mean, these were a bunch of people that basically had been out of power for 15 years, and you know that'll lead to some blunders initially. But the other thing is that Hariyama campaigned on the idea that the base in Okinawa was going to be moved so that it would wouldn't take as strategic or a significant a slice of real estate, And that kind of upset, I believe, 2 years of delicate negotiations mm-hmm. between the Defense Department and the previous government in Japan as to what was going to be dealt with. And I think Gates slapped down Hatoyama pretty quickly on that, if memory serves. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And as a result, you know, I think this is the triggering issue, but to think that this was the only reason that Hatoyama decided to resign, I think is foolhardy.
Right. No, I think that that's absolutely correct. It is rare for foreign policy events to by themselves cause this sort of event. Although, you know, I mean, I think people should start maybe reviewing the odds of the Netanyahu government falling now because of the fallout from this incident in and around Israel. Whether eventually people are just going to sort of become less tolerant of what appears to be just signal incompetence. And so,
well, I mean,
which isn't quite Obama toppling Netanyahu, but I think people are going to have to start asking difficult questions in Israel about whether Netanyahu is really good for anything besides bellicose rhetoric.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues here. I mean, the first is you're right. I mean, the Netanyahu government is not, you know, on this issue it hasn't done terribly well. It's worth pointing out that the Israeli economy, I think, is actually growing at a pretty robust pace, and they just joined the OECD. So there are ways in which, you know, I mean, it really is the economy very often that determines a lot of these things. And in Japan, it wasn't performing terribly well, whereas in Israel, it is performing terribly well. And that's part of the reason I think the Netanyahu government might wind up surviving longer than you suggest. And the other problem is always, what is the alternative if you kick out Netanyahu? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Kadima. And Kadima's performance, particularly on this area, from 2006 to 2008 was not terribly robust either.
Right. I mean, the Netanyahu government came to power essentially apologizing for that performance, right? That was sort of the point.
So, I mean, in some way, I agree with you that I think Netanyahu has been dragged down by this, but I think, you know, much like Obama will campaign saying, look, you know, compare me to Bush, Netanyahu is going to campaign saying, compare me to Olmert or, you know, Livni as the successor to Kadima. He might be able to survive much longer. The interesting question is whether, and I don't think this is going to happen now, because I think rhetorically Obama tried to lean on Netanyahu hard about 6 months ago, and I think has stepped back from that. I mean, there is a precedent for the U.S. actually intervening successfully in Israeli domestic politics, and this was in the run-up to the Madrid conference in 1992, when the George H.W. Bush administration froze some loan guarantees that were supposed to go for the construction of housing settlements. And eventually that led to the Shamir government falling and Yitzhak Rabin becoming elected.
Right.
I'm not sure that could work this time, however, because while it would certainly, you know, be unpopular with Netanyahu, you would still inevitably have a coalition government replacing this coalition government. And I think in some ways that's the real problem in Israel, which is any coalition that comes to power is inevitably going to have a few parties that are only going to want to pursue a settlements uber alles policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, that's not going to change.
Right. And so it's a function of the Israeli political system that you have what many regard as an untenable situation with regard to this. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you a question, which is, do you think that, you know, as more, I mean, we talked about how it would affect global public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that enough of these incidents, if they rack up, are eventually actually going to alter? I mean, because regardless of what you think about an Israel lobby or so forth, there is a very strong and robust public support in this country for Israel. That's not because of an interest group. That's just, I think you can argue, because of historical ties. Do you think that enough of these incidents would cause an actual shift in American public opinion?
What I think it will cause a shift, but the way the shift will play out is really interesting. I think that what I suspect is that how the actual shift will play out will be in terms of the growing a growing partisan divide in terms of thinking about the relationship with Israel. Whereas historically, and as you mentioned, George H.W. Bush, you know, the Democrat, but support for Israel has been broadly bipartisan. At some points in the past, the Republicans have been somewhat more distant from Israel than they are now. Now they're relatively close. What I suspect is that even if the overall numbers for support for Israel don't change, and they may not change by all that much, that you are going to see a substantially more partisan character to support for Israel within the United States.
Where Republicans become much more, maintain the relationship, and Democrats become much more skeptical?
Right, right. And I think the word skeptical is right. They don't become anti-Israel, but they become more skeptical of the value of the relationship, more skeptical of just how far, you know, we should go to preserve the relationship and so forth. And so that's what I suspect we will see in terms of a shift, even if we don't. And that's dangerous for Israel, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's not good for Israel for Israel to become a domestic issue within the United States that is fought over partisan lines. That's bad for the Israelis.
And you can argue that part. I mean, as much as Obama has made mistakes, I think you can argue Netanyahu has made mistakes in dealing with the Obama administration. I think one of the reasons for that is that a lot of his advice is coming from people that are much more closely tied to the GOP than to the Democrats.
Right, right. I think that's absolutely true, and that don't are sort of understanding the U.S.-Israel relationship within the context of American domestic politics, which is again a terrible way for the Israelis to try to frame the U.S.-Israel relationship.
Right.
And so that's the shift that I would expect in the future, and I think that shift will play out even more because of the developing media environment, right, sort of the postmodern media environment, where essentially everybody makes their own media reality. And so if you watch Fox News, then the ten people who were killed were all members of Al-Qaeda. If you watch some other show, then they have a sort of a different view.
Yeah.
And that will even exacerbate this tendency towards sort of polarization on the question of Israel.
So to conclude, then, we're both skeptical about Israel's strategic situation, in part because of the Israel's domestic political morass and because of the polarization of information in the United States.
Right.
Well, on that cheery note.
All right. Well, it has been good talking to you.
Yes. Always a pleasure, Rob.
All right.
Take care.
Well, then, have a good day.
Okay. You too.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.